Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 94 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says my music is better than yours. Now, firstly, let me just address the elephant in the room. A huge apology to everyone who's been waiting on new episodes of This Day Rocks. Sadly, I was unwell for a little while, and the pre-recorded shows ran out during that time. Also, as a self-employed freelance audio producer and editor, my own workload suddenly went boom. And then add into the mix family commitments, four young kids and all that kind of stuff, it all became a little bit too much. And as regular listeners will know, Vintage Rock Pod really is a one-man band. I literally do everything. The researching, the writing, the scripting, sourcing guests, doing the interviews, editing the interviews for podcasts and the videos for YouTube, recording the episodes, editing the episodes, uploading the episodes, writing the show notes, writing the descriptions, making the artwork, looking after social media, dealing with press releases, I mean literally the whole shebang. All whilst being self-employed with no paid out holidays or anything like that, and with a young family, so unfortunately something has to give. And as much as I've loved doing the daily episodes, which I've done for well over a year now, sadly This Day Rocks for the time being has to be shelved. I am thinking about perhaps doing a less frequent version, focusing on days with big events, perhaps like Woodstock or Live Aid anniversaries, that kind of thing, or birthdays of legends, or release date anniversaries for iconic albums. Maybe throw a few in a month, perhaps. I'm not sure yet. I haven't really thought it all through. And then there's other ideas. Maybe I could do a side two show, which reflects more on that week's big interview guests. Maybe more of a deep dive into their catalogue and achievements sort of thing. I'm not 100% sure yet, just playing with some of these ideas, but I would love to hear what you think of these kind of things. I mean, at the end of the day, I produce Vintage Rock Pod for you listening right now. You make it worthwhile. All that effort that I put in definitely comes down to you. So if you've got any thoughts, please do let me know. Drop me an email, vintagerockpod@gmail.com. And that leads me on to some thank yous. A huge thanks to Kenneth Hoggins, Mark Walters, Jeremy Cade, Bane Carlston, Andy Old, Pete Forrest, and Dave Taylor, who all sent emails this week when the This Day Rocks wasn't going out. Each and every one of you inquired as to my health, hoping that I was okay. Again, it sounds silly, but I've never met any of you guys. So for you to enjoy Vintage Rock Pod enough to actually get in touch, it means an awful lot. It really does. Thank you so much. Now, the big interview shows will still go ahead on Mondays. I've got some great guests lined up, as always. Although, in all honesty, being out of action for a little while means I'm struggling to fill next Monday's hole, but I'll see what I can do. I've got five great rock stars lined up to interview in the coming weeks that I know you're going to love. So if you could show a little patience and enjoy the big interview shows, that would be much obliged. Anyway, let's go back to this week's show then. Today's interview is with another fantastic character, just like last week's guest, Guy Pratt, which if you haven't heard that one yet, definitely do go back and check it out. He's worked with so many legends. Anyway, today's guest was a prodigy, earning entry to the Juilliard School for Classical Playing, but opted not to go so that he could pursue his dream of being a rock star. Despite working with the likes of the Porcaro brothers from Toto and Jeff Skunk Baxter, his first real band didn't take off, but fate had it that none other than Richie freaking Blackmore heard him and invited him to join Rainbow, and he only went and played on the classic, iconic, legendary Rainbow Rising album. In fact, his keyboard playing is the very first thing you hear on that record. Yes, today's guest is Tony Carey. Known for his impeccable musicianship and versatility, Carey's keyboard wizardry blended seamlessly with Richie Blackmore's guitar prowess, helping to create the signature sound that fans around the world came to love. But Tony's career didn't stop at Rainbow. Following his departure from the band after 3 years, he embarked on a successful solo career, releasing a string of hits that showcased his songwriting skills and musical versatility. The songs like A Fine, Fine Day that propelled him into the mainstream. There were 7 Billboard hits, including that one, 2 of those going top 40, and so many more hits in Europe and around the world as well. It solidified his status as a solo artist with a unique and captivating sound. He also released music as an electronic sci-fi type theme under the name of Planet P Project, where he scored more hit records and singles like Why Me, which became a huge staple of MTV in the 80s too. He also worked with a lot of stars in a producer capacity, and you'll hear all about this and more in this fascinating interview with him. So please enjoy this fun chat with a man who says it like it is. Here's Tony Carey. I saw an interview with you once where you spoke about having loved music from a really early age. Now, was it always kind of the piano and the keyboards that had you interested in music, or did you dabble with other instruments when you were younger?
Well, I mean, I saw the Beatles, like a lot of people will tell you this at my age, I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was 11, and in the Rolling Stones, Hermits, the whole British invasion, and Elvis before that. And, you know, everybody wanted to be and it was all guitar music, so I had an acoustic guitar. But when I was 5 years old, we had a piano in the house, and I couldn't kind of stay away from it. And I was always on it, my mother tells me, and told me, and was fascinated with music. And we had the usual hits of the day. In our case, it was Joan Baez, Harry Belafonte, yeah. whatever the popular music of the 50s. I was born in 53 and going on. So I was interested in music, but piano wasn't my primary instrument. What I studied was contrabass, was a double okay. bass orchestral. Yeah, yeah. And I played in orchestras, school orchestras, and was actually headed for a career as an orchestral musician. I was, after high school, I got accepted to some really prestigious top music schools, Juilliard in New York and Rochester in upstate New York. And at the same time, I always had a rock band since I was 11. And I was in we're doing rhythm and blues covers and stuff, and I was playing piano and singing. And my bass professor, this was interesting, the professor that instructed me on the contrabass and had a lot of influence with me applying to these music schools and everything. He says, well, here's what you can do. You can go to Juilliard and graduate, and in 5 years, you'll be the number 2 bassist in the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra. He says, or you can hit the road with your rock and roll band and get all the pussy you can eat. I mean, basically I'd go for it and go have fun, because it was obvious that I was more interested in music, you know, popular music than orchestral music. And I flattered myself that I had the discipline to sit and play somebody else's music my whole life, but in retrospect, I doubt it. I doubt it would have worked out.
So what did your parents make of that? Obviously, they were supportive of the music side of it, but for you choosing to not go to school and study at this prestigious school.
My dad jumped through hoops because he didn't have to pay for Juilliard. We weren't rich. I mean, those places cost a fortune, and you either get a full scholarship or it costs, I mean, even in the 70s, like 1971, it would have been $30,000 a year, just for tuition, and then living in New York City is the most expensive city in the world and all that. So my dad actually was probably secretly pretty happy about it. They were supportive of anything I wanted to do my whole life. So it wasn't even an issue. They said, well, you know, wish you luck. Right. If we have a saying, right, if you get work, not when you get work, but if you get work. And, I took off with a high school buddy, and we hit the road. We started a band, and 2 years later, we had a record deal. We were good. We were like a folk rock band, like Poco or Before the Eagles, And I wasn't the singer. We had a lot of three-part harmony, like Crosby, Stills, and Nash influence. I wasn't the lead singer. I played piano and bass in the band. And we got a record deal, which got us out to Los Angeles. ABC Dunhill Records signed us for an obscene amount of money, and it's all about being in the right place in the right time. And we were close to New York, and the guy that heard us was from New York, based in New York, and you know, we weren't in Indiana somewhere, and or out in the sticks or North Dakota or whatever, and we were close to where record deals were being offered, and we got one. They sent us out, and all of a sudden we're in West Hollywood, you know, in 1973, and we tried forever to get a record made. We had Gary Katz producing, the guy from Steely Dan, who was famous for first of all never finishing records, or
I hoped,
or firing the whole band, and you know, keep like what Steely Dan did, and keeping two guys. So they fired our bass player and drummer before they didn't even played a note. And our the other two guys in the band weren't allowed to get both guitar players weren't allowed to play guitar. So what, in other words, they sabotaging exactly what the record label had signed was the charm of these young kids doing our own songs. And they were obviously charming. Somebody thought it was worth putting $1 million into, and good old Gary kind of sabotage that. And so we hung around in a studio for way over a year. We're living in the Chateau Marmont Hotel on Sunset Strip, like Hollywood swinging, as they say. And we were playing, I was playing with Jeff Porcaro, was in the band for a while. I mean, these are all session guys, but they were going to be playing the album. Jeff Porcaro's brother Mike was playing bass. And Skunk Baxter was playing guitar.
Incredible.
And we were rehearsing at SIR Studios in Hollywood, preparing a song to try to yet another attempt to get something that we recorded. And Richie was two doors down looking to put together Rainbow for the Rising lineup. And he had everything but a keyboard player. He had Cozy was there, Ronnie was there, and Jimmy and Reggie, and he heard me playing Hammond through probably about 8 walls. I was not shy, and sent actually Jimmy Bain over to ask me if I wanted to audition for the band. And I was at a point with my own band that it didn't look like it was going anywhere, and it wouldn't have gone anywhere. So I said, too much politics, too much Gary Katz, too much cocaine, too much everything. And I said, yeah, go for it. And the rest is history.
So what happened with the recordings of that? You must have recorded some stuff when you were with that band. I mean, did that ever see the light of day?
Shit tons of stuff, but I didn't have any influence over it. I don't know where it is. We had reels and reels and reels of 2-inch tapes, of course, somewhere. ABC Dunhill Records went bankrupt, unsurprisingly, at one point, and merged with somebody that eventually emerged with Universal, and I have no idea, or maybe Warner's. And then a bunch of 2-inch tapes got burned up in this huge Warner Brothers fire in California many years ago. I have no idea. I never heard anything. And this was like before the internet, before MP3s, before digital. Yeah. It's not like we'd have rough mixes to take home at night, you know, on our smartphones or anything. We're talking about 50 years ago. So,
yeah, such a shame. But you touched on joining Rainbow there. First question then, Graham Bonnet told me you'd never heard of the band Rainbow when he joined. Had you heard of Rainbow?
I was well aware of it because the California Jam had been a year before, and Richie did his whole thing where he smashed a guitar up and put his guitar through a $100,000 TV camera. I thought that's cool, and loved the band anyway. I mean, you know, big, loud, present, noisy, rambunctious. What's not to love? And then right in, I'm going to say end of 74 or very beginning of 75, Man on a Silver Mountain had been released. It was all over the radio in LA. So I was quite aware of the band. I didn't know anything what Rainbow was. I'd never heard of Ronnie, of course. I didn't know anything about Elf, but Richie's name on it, and it's a great singer, and it's a really cool song. And so everybody's quite aware. But Graham was coming from Australia, that he hadn't heard of it. It doesn't surprise me. But I was I was in Southern California, and I was aware of it, yeah.
Well aware of the band. So when they approached you and said, come and play with us, come and try out, I mean, obviously you were struggling with your previous band. I mean, what was going through your head at that stage, being a young man? You'd heard of this band, Richie Blackmore, famous virtuoso. What were you thinking at this stage?
I called my dad the night that I'd met Jimmy Bain. I said, hey, guess what, Pop? I'm going to be a rock and roll star. And he said, I thought you already were one. And I said, no, I mean a real one. I said, I'm going on a play with this guy from Deep Purple tomorrow, and I'm probably going to join his band. I said, well, good luck, like he always did. Right if you get work. And so it was pretty exciting because it's not that you give things a lot of existential thought when you're a teenager, or I was maybe 20 at the time. It's just take it like it comes, but it always seemed to come, you know. Yeah. Without me making any immense effort or to push things or fight things, the universe seemed to be blowing things in my direction that all I had to do was reach out my hand and grab them. So that was one of them.
Incredible stuff. And what stage were the band at that point? I think you said Cozy was there already. So had they started work on the new record?
There. Everybody was there. Okay. And we had, Richie had tried, like, I heard stories. I didn't know these people, but I knew of them. I know that the guy from the Vanilla Fudge had auditioned, and the guy from Roxy Music, Eddie Jobson, had auditioned, and some Italian guy, but all the Hammond guys had like auditioned, and synth guys, and he didn't like any of them. And so I had never played hard rock music, but I could bluff my way into a convent as a cucumber salesman. And I was kind of, you know, bluffing, but, you know, it's loud, it's rough, it's heavy Hammond. I knew what Rick Wakeman was doing, and yeah, obviously aware of what John had played before, you know, Made in Japan was all over the place, too. So, I knew what he was kind of looking for. Like a little bit of, you know, fake classical, really loud with a little prog touch. And the first stages, we were right on the road. We rehearsed for a while, and we did, I think, 9 or 10 shows in America. And not everybody knows this, but these are all like on YouTube, actually. They're all bootlegged. Every single show we ever played, we played in Canada, we played in New York, we played in Detroit, we played in Florida, we played in Texas. Then we played 9 shows anyway, just to like warm up as a band. And after which we went to Munich and into Musicland Studios and did Rainbow Rising in about 10 minutes.
Wow. I love that kind of throwaway. We just did Rainbow Rising. I mean, one of the greatest albums of all time, still revered today. It's still up there.
That's
in terms of doing it.
it surprises me. I mean, that amazes me that that's, I mean, the respect that album gets 50 years later, nearly 50 years later, is astonishing to me. And that's great. Fantastic.
And in terms of the record itself, I mean, was it the sort of thing that Richie just came and said, this is what we're doing? Or was it a band process? Or how did that kind of thing work for that record?
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
He never told me what to play. He never told Cozy what to play. I think he sat with Ronnie. I wasn't there. We did. He did Ronnie. The vocals he did with just Ronnie and Martin Birch. But my keyboard parts, it was just me and Martin Birch. Richie'd fuck off and go somewhere else and come back and either like it or not like it. And he liked it. And it was no like dictatorial anything. And I never got musically, we were on the same page. I mean, everybody. Jimmy was kicking ass on the bass. Cozy was a monster. You know, Ronnie was Ronnie. Richie was Richie at the top of his game. I was keeping up, I guess, apparently. Nobody ever told me I wasn't. And it was like rolling off a log. It was musically speaking, getting the music part done was, like I said, we made it in 10 minutes. It was no sweat. I heard later that there'd been some discussion about, and there always is, you know, about the vocal melodies and exactly that, you know, they probably spent the most time getting the vocals right. But the bottom tracks, we'd do three a day and come in and do the keyboards. He wanted an intro for Tarot Woman. Keyboard intro, and I did that in 2 hours with Martin. And he wanted a solo for A Light in the Black. I did that in 2 hours with Martin. That was one time he had made a suggestion. I played it in a high kind of your usual minimum register, which is like up at the top register. He says, how about if you do something, you know, how about a 12 string? How about if you do something in a lower octave? I said, yeah, that's a great idea. So I did. And he came back. He says, yeah, I like that. I'm basically good to go. Incredible. So no sweat. The music was not the problem. There weren't any problems. The music was not the problem. Music was like effortless.
And how did it, just touching on Tarot Woman, obviously it's the opening track. It's the first thing we hear. It's you on your keyboard, your synthesizer, that kind of thing. I mean, you say you were asked to write something. Was it just off the top of your head? Was it kind of pre-planned? How did it go?
Yeah, it was free form off the top of my head. The hardest part was I played this improv piece. Rainbow was all about improvisation. If you've heard the live albums on stage, of course, but then there's an 80 variations, 80 live recordings from that tour, the 76. I never played the same thing twice. And I still haven't to this day played the same thing twice in my life. I don't learn parts. And the tricky bit was getting something that I like. And the tricky bit, because we didn't work like these days, you'd work with a click track or some kind of metronome or a drummer or something. It was just free form, loose time. The tricky part was doubling it because it was too many moves. And that's what took the most time, getting the first mini move with the little melody in it. That was easy. And then Birch said, why don't we do a little? I said, I know what you want. And he said, so putting the second one, and that took the most time because there was no pattern. You know, I just had to like read my own mind and get it. But we got it. It was about 2 hours.
Wow. Phenomenal stuff. And as you mentioned there, I mean, you were with the band for, I think, about 3 years, weren't you? And the music wasn't the problem, but the other side of it. I mean, you're a bit younger than the rest of the guys. I mean, how was that dynamic?
Well, me being oblivious, it wasn't really much of a dynamic. As long as we were playing, everything was cool. If we weren't playing, I didn't really have much to say to anybody, except for Jimmy. Jimmy and me were buddies. And Ronnie. Ronnie and I got along really, really well. But we were like the Americans. And this band was Ronnie and me, and this band was very much Americans against the Brits, as it were. and Cozy and Richie were an ultra British. And Ronnie is from upstate New York, and I knew Ronnie before I met him. I knew him. You know, I mean, this is like an American guy, and he's older than me, but still, he's like an uncle. So we got along fine. The dynamic in the band, I mean, you know, show up, do your job. I mean, I got fired a couple of times. And then hired back. And the third time, I just had enough of the nonsense. I just left. In the middle of the Long Live Rock and Roll album, there was some shenanigans. I just hit the road in the middle of the night and got out of there.
There you go. You mentioned Ronnie there. I mean, absolute legend, iconic voice. I mean, not a voice like it in the world of rock. I mean, what was he like as a person and someone to work with? And what was it like watching him on stage when he was belting out these classics?
I think I was there the first time he threw the devil horns, actually.
I think.
I was on stage. I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of people will say that they've been that you know, they were the first person to whatever. I think 40 million people will say that they saw the place hit the Twin Towers, you know, in a city of 8 million. But whatever, I will maintain to this day that I was on stage with the first time Ronnie threw the devil horns. He's a great guy. If you saw him in interviews, that's the way he was. I mean, straight ahead, you know, pretty much dead honest. He gave you his opinion the way he called him like he saw him. You know, he could be bitchy like everybody can, mostly really a gentleman. I mean, he's an Italian fella, Italian-American from upstate New York. They have this, they're very polite. And even if he's about to stab you in the back, he's not swearing at you. They have this gentlemanly air about him. He was a real gentleman. And he was always lovely to me. And Wendy, his wife, she was with him from the early days. I don't think they were married at the time, but she was with us the whole time in the studio, on the road in the studio, on the Rising tour, and then in the Long Live Rock and Roll sessions, and in the Rising sessions. Wendy was always there. She was great too. Just great people.
Fantastic stuff. And you mentioned some shenanigans around you leaving. What was it that actually led to you leaving? Was there any regrets afterwards that you'd left?
From their side, I think so. They had to look all over the place to get a replacement. Hell no, I was happy to get out of there. There is some crazy shit. They were into this occult, or Richie was into this occult thing, and he was calling up, having seances with Ouija boards, and it was getting dangerous, scary, and a little bit violent. And I thought, it's time for me to go. And I don't want to say much more about it. It's pretty much been documented, and I regret anything I might have said about it when I was a lot younger, but it's nobody's business. But call it a major personality clash. You know, I mean, and as one of the only four Rainbow members to ever, I mean, there've been 40 of us. I think there's been quite a series of major personality clashes over the years. So I don't want to get into that. That guy's a great guitar player.
He is indeed. And soon after leaving, you found yourself in Germany. The decision to move there, many would see that as an unusual move. What inspired that?
Well, being oblivious. I had met people on the road in Germany, and a guy called me in 70. I left the band in fall of 77, flew back to L.A., and I got a telegram. Remember those?
Oh, wow.
A telegram. Maybe you don't remember those, but they were pieces of paper hand-delivered that said, asked me if I could come to Munich to work as a session musician. To help a guy record an album. I said, sure, send me a ticket. And he did. And I loved Europe from the minute I saw it. It was like going to Mars. I mean, it was, especially for me, I was not well-traveled. And then we had done a world tour, been to Australia, saw Japan, saw Europe. And I loved Europe. I loved Germany. And while I was here, this was in August of 78. It's been 45 years. I met some people. One guy I met had a recording studio in Frankfurt, and I made a deal with him that I'd come in when all the paying customers had gone, like at midnight, and with my little cassette recorder and play the piano and just, you know, goof around trying to compose stuff. And that led to me getting some studio time, and that led to me to making records in the beginning, electronic records like Kraftwerk inspired, Frog, kind of goofy electronic drum machine music, which led to me figuring out how to play guitar and bass on records, and which led to a record deal in America, because this guy had connections, which led to some big hit singles in the States for me, and some huge singles for me here in Europe, and albums. And I mean, I had seven songs in the Hot 100 in America, and two top 40, and a number one in the radio charts, a song called A Fine, Fine Day. And, you know, that's did good. I was on MTV a lot.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And then all of that led to me producing. And then I spent a long, long time to actually living in the studio producing people. I produced people like Joe Cocker and Chris Norman from Smokey, and all these unlikely people, because I never cared about the music, about the genre. I just cared if it was good or not, you know, and trusted myself to know if something was good. I produced Jose Carreras, the opera singer, you know, all kinds of different shit, just all kinds of different shit. And, you know, just when you start having, and I started having children, you know, and a family, and I wasn't about to drag my half German family and relocate to California, you know, in the middle of all this. And in the meantime, my kids are you know, in their 40s, 30s and 40s. And I just stayed.
Yeah. You ran through an awful lot of your career in short time there. Let's rewind a little bit to the very start of what you were saying there, when you were saying you're in the studio and you got to learn the guitar and putting down different things. I mean, that sounds like it must have been a really kind of, I don't know how to explain this, like a really nice way anyway of being in the studio and working and at your own pace and finding things out and learning. It must have been a really happy time for you, was it?
Well, the whole life's been a happy time, including now, but I tell you what, it was a free college education in how to use analog studios, which means cutting 2-inch tape with a razor blade. There are kids, there are other reasons to have a razor blade in the studio. The second one being cutting tape and real analog tape and gluing it together and learning all the stuff, learning how to engineer what all those dials meant and all those patch cords did and then everything, and how to mic up a drum kit and how to mic up a guitar amp and how to stack vocals and record. And I learned all that like a free apprenticeship, at the same time having the luxury of having enough early success that it was actually making them money. It wasn't costing anybody any money, you know, and I was actually selling records and writing songs for other people. I've published over the years between 1,100 and 1,200 songs, depending on how you count them. Sometimes a song will be like 20 little pieces in a film soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So, but say 1,100, and then you know, just writers write, and I'm a writer, and you just write and write and write. And sometimes I do two a day. Sometimes I do 20 a month. So, you know, for years and years and years, I lived in the studio.
Phenomenal.
And it sounds like I'm saying it casually, and I guess I am now. But in retrospect, I worked my ass off, and it was a great way to kill 40 years. I mean, you know, have fun. I never had a real job in my life. And, you know, I never had a boss in my life. The only boss I ever had in my life was Richie Blackmore, as a matter of fact. And I quit that job. So, yeah.
Fair enough. And you mentioned your hits. You had seven over there in America, over in America. And the two big ones, A Fine, Fine Day, The First Day of Summer. Was it that a prominent member of...
Those aren't the big ones. Those are two of the big ones,
yeah.
I had a separate project called Planet P Project.
We'll get to that in a second. But firstly, ones I mentioned.
Okay.
I just want to hear about the Geffen story. The guy, the prominent member of Geffen that didn't like... Well, they signed you, they liked the songs, but he wanted the... Was it the lyrics changing and the parts changing and things like that?
Yeah, you heard that story. I must have shot my mouth off on another podcast. this guy... I don't want to dignify him by saying his name, but he was like the most important A&R guy if you do some research, you'll figure out who it is. He loved the song. He didn't like the lyrics. He didn't like "A Fine, Fine Day for a Reunion" is about my uncle that I didn't actually have, but I invented, who'd gotten out of prison, been in prison for 20 years, and he comes out and he'd hidden some money, and they were still after the money, and it's the mafia type thing. This is a story. And he didn't like that lyric. He wanted to be called in the Heat of the Night. Now, that's all I'm going to tell you. He wanted to be called something like that. And the second one was a song called "The First Day of Summer," which I thought was, if I hadn't been a songwriter, I would have been an author. And I thought it was very, very lyrical. But the feeling was, on the first day of summer, the whole world knows your name, which is like, you walk out and you feel that good. You know, everybody knows my name. I'm the man. It's the first day of summer. Nothing could be better. He hated that. He thought I should be slided in or anything, anything other than the first day of summer. And I was of the opinion, silly me, that my job was to make the music and the label's job was to sell it. And this was exactly in the early 80s where that was changing, where A&R guys at these big labels, Geffen included, would actually sit with the artist from soup to nuts through the whole procedure and like be able to say things like, "I think you should change these lyrics." Well, I'm a little older school than that. I said, "Well, listen, if you don't like my songs, then we don't have to record them. I don't have to release them. I can go somewhere else." And I did eventually. So Geffen did release the eponymous Planet P Project album. And this is also a funny story because I had two record deals. Yeah. I actually had three, but I had two record deals, which nobody ever has. One under Tony Carey and one under Planet P. And Planet P was like a science fiction concept album. Very tongue-in-cheek. I mean, Why Me, the first single was about an astronaut that gets a panic attack when he's on, the countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7. He says, "No, I don't, change my mind, fellas." And it's too late. And my Fine, Fine Day, First Day of Summer, the songs from Tony Carey were story songs with a protagonist and a story and a beginning, middle, and end. And so we'd already agreed, okay, I could be in Tony Carey videos, but I can't be in Planet P videos because that confused everybody even more than they already were, including me. And Geffen, the David Geffen Company, signed both of those projects. And we released the Planet P record. It did fairly well, Why Me in particular, but there was three songs that made it to MTV. There was three MTV videos, and it was got a shit ton of radio in America and in Germany and in Japan and in all around Europe. And so that was that. And then came time for the first Tony Carey album, which would have been an album called Some Tough City. And this is where I had my run-in about the lyrics. I said, "No, I'm not changing anything." Oh, and they wanted to cut "A Fine, Fine Day" from 4:40. I agree that's too long for a single, but they wanted to cut the whole bridge out, which really explains what was going on. Okay. It's the whole key to the song. And I'm more of a lyricist than I am a... I don't think in terms of 3-minute blocks of music. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, if I had, maybe it would have been a bigger record than it was, but didn't care. And I still don't care. I had a story to tell, and this 40 seconds that they wanted to cut out was like the meat of the story. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like anybody just like approached me and said, "Let's talk about it." They sent me this demo cut. I said, "No." And okay, good. So they traded me to Irving Azoff, the Eagles manager who was running MCA Records. They traded me like a baseball player, or like an old Harley. And all of a sudden, I'm MCA recording artist, Tony Carey / Planet P Project, and so Some Tough City, and then a Planet P record, second Planet P record, a double concept pink bubblegum album called Pink World, and the following album called Blue Highway all came out on MCA. Very confusing.
Very confusing indeed for everybody. Yeah. Some Tough Cities, that is a fantastic record. I love the tracks on there. Tinsel Town and Eddie Goes Underground. I love those sorts of things. Brilliant record. Yeah.
These are complete These are complete autobiographical. I mean, I lived in the seamiest side of LA, which is West Hollywood, for several years. And these are all like true stories, all these criminals and shady characters. And Eddie Goes Underground is, you heard about your trouble up in Stanislaus County. That's where I'm from, Stanislaus County, California. These are all autobiographical, and they're all like basically true. The names weren't even changed to protect the innocent. I was too young to know about that. So, but thanks that you, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned a few times there about the MTV play and the radio play and things like that. Some people not really bothered by things like that. But how did you feel at that time seeing your records, your things you've put out there that you've created that be played on MTV all the time and across Europe and on radio and everything? How did that feel?
Didn't love it. Didn't love it, hated it. Got out of there as soon as I could, never went back. I didn't like it at all. I mean, my idea of rock, I'm a 70s guy or even a 60s guy. And my idea of rock is the band has a mystique and an image, and you don't have to see everything. And it doesn't have to be sexy girls in a video because there isn't a video. And if they come to play in your town, you go see them, and then word of mouth spreads it, and the occasional a mystique like Zeppelin had. Zeppelin weren't an MTV band, or you know, Creedence Clearwater, or the Doors, or the Big Brother and the Holding Company, or the Grateful Dead. These are the bands I like, and they were all Fleetwood Mac. They're really good 60s and 70s bands. For me, it's all about the mystique, you know. And all of a sudden, you put cameras on people that aren't actors, and you know, it's pretty much ridiculous. And then it led to the inevitable, which is glam. You know, put the David Lee Ross, the guys that are actors and can wear spandex, and all these, you know, Motley Crue and all the next gen. We were a kind of a LA strip band, Rainbow. By the way, we were based in West Hollywood. We took our name from the Rainbow Bar and Grill in Hollywood. So I consider us a LA band, even though those two Brits and a New Yorker and me and. But the next generation was in the early 80s. They were like 5, 6, 7 years later than us. And this is glam rock, which took over everything from, you know, Warrant or Poison or
Rat,
whatever. Van Halen, Rat, all of that stuff. And they were like made for MTV. And then Coverdale, when he came back with his new look and his sexy girlfriend and all that, great. That did him well. But I hated it. I thought, this is, if I wanted to be on TV, I'd be on a soap opera. I mean, I hated it and still do. And, but you know, that's the way the music business changed. I'll tell you, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, though, were the best time to be in the music industry. That it'll never be the same. And before that, it wasn't the same. And before about 1970, you couldn't make any money because you get ripped off by everybody. And Peter Grant changed that with Led Zeppelin in like 1969, 1970. And all of a sudden, Led Zeppelin was getting 90% of the income of the gate of the shows. Before, you know, they would buy a blues singer's catalog for a bottle of Jim Beam, you know. And he's fucked and somebody else got rich. Or the Colonel with Elvis had 50% anyway and embezzled 40% of the rest. And left Elvis with a drug habit and a private jet that you know, had to pay the gas for and play in Vegas and splitting his pants because of his pill habit. So that was 50s, 60s. And then 70s and in the 80s and pretty much through the 90s. By the end of the 90s, things were slowing down. By the end of the 90s, music had become devalued to the point where file sharing came. Mm-hmm. And we had the whole Metallica, Napster. Lars was right. Something is only worth as much as somebody else will pay for it. And, you know, there's a perceived value, like, to music. And in the 70s and the 80s, it was quite high. And you could make a lot of money and do real well for yourself, be it on the radio, the radio pays crazy good. MTV pays enormously at that time. But all of a sudden, music is free. You could download it. And then, you know, just way before Spotify, but the same principle. If something's free, it's not worth anything. If, you know, if I give you a, if you're out in the desert and I give you a bag of diamonds or a Cola Light, which are you going to take? The bag of diamonds isn't worth anything. And if music is free and you can get it on demand and not pay anything for it, and it'll go watch your bands on MTV for free, it kind of takes the, it demonetizes it and waters it down to the point that it's really tough to make a living making music.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I don't know what I'd tell it. If I don't have sons, I just have daughters. But if I had a son that wanted to be a rock and roller, I don't know. I'd tell him, get that law degree, which my father never told me, you know, because it was the golden years, and, you know, go for it, follow your dream and this and that. But there's not much of a dream to follow now since the commodity has devaluated to the point where it's basically worthless. It's free. That's as political as I'll get.
That's
now
fine,
we can talk
me.
About the sex and drugs part.
That's fine by me. In terms of, you mentioned earlier, if you weren't a musician, you probably would have been an author, and that kind of, you mentioned Planet P Project there a few times and the sci-fi things around it. Were you a sci-fi fan yourself then?
I was an everything fan, but I've just read everything. Fiction, not music, yeah. Fiction, like everything from Steinbeck, Hemingway to Heinlein. I mean, Planet P was in Heinlein's novel Starship Trooper on page 300 and something. There's just a mention of they blew by Planet P, and then so you never hear of it again. It was just this
throwaway
random
line.
Thing. So,
yeah.
So that's my name of my band, of course, and. But not many people know that. I haven't said that a lot, but it's come from the novel Starship Troopers. I would have been a writer. I might even have been a journalist. I mean, just writing. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, the thing that presented itself as possible, and that it was a lot of fun, and that I was turned out to be okay, not bad at, is short form, which is lyrics.
Fantastic. And in terms of some of the production work, then you mentioned it earlier, Chris Norman from Smokey, and like you said, Joe Cocker as well, and things like that. I suppose for a man who spent so much time in the studio like you, it was a natural progression. So how did that come about? When did someone first approach you and say, can you produce me or this act?
Well, the biggest guy that it wanted, the first real production offer I got was in 1985. And the biggest rock star in Europe is a guy called Peter Maffay. And you won't know his name, but he's a German, sings in German. He sold 50 million German language records. And he's had, this is Guinness Book stuff, he's had 21 number one albums.
Wow.
Which in a major market is like more than the Beatles, though. Anybody, Michael Jackson, anybody. And he's still my best buddy. And he wanted some rock cred. He was kind of a more of an easy listening singer, and he's down in the Munich area, and I was up in Frankfurt, and he showed up in the studio one day, and I knew who he was. He's a huge star and a real cool guy, just like jeans and cowboy boots and a bottle of whiskey, and we got to know each other, and he says, you want to come down to and work on my record, and, you know, help me produce the rest? Fuck yeah, I'm there. And so I did three records for him, and they're all number one. But in truth, if the guy that cut you the lawn producing, they would have been number one. I mean, this is Peter Maffay in his the most successful phase of his career. We'd go on tour. I'd be his special guest. We'd be like some of the acts are now. We'd be in a city in the local arena 8 nights in a row. You know, in the 20,000 seater, and we'd sell 100 to 150,000 tickets in Munich, and then in Berlin and in Hamburg. He would not we. I say he. And so I was along for the ride. And he wanted some rock credibility, first of all, and he wanted somebody that wouldn't lie to him. You know, I wasn't going to, like, tell him something just because he wanted to hear it, you know. And, you know, I told him what I thought, and what I thought lined up with what he figured enough that it works. It was a successful partnership. That led to people, just that production credit of producing Peter Maffay, just the phone wouldn't stop ringing. And then I had a number one hit here, and it's still one of the top 20 five, I think it's number 20 something, 21 or something, all time biggest records in Germany. I mean, ever. That was never released anywhere else except Germany. It's called Room with a View, and it was the soundtrack to a miniseries that was on TV in 1989 at Christmas and had the biggest audience share, hits, record-breaking, this and that. And that's just like a mega, mega, mega hit that everybody here that owns a radio knows. And that got a lot of, you know, that was a really good credit to have because I played every instrument on that record. Made it myself with a guy. I had one guy, a guy engineering because I can't do everything. But basically, me and this other guy did everything. And that, you know, word got around. And so what would happen with a guy like, say, Joe? Joe was touring through Europe. He's a Brit, and a good guy. And this was after his disaster years. He was like, he was down to just a couple beers. He's a great guy. And the record company, his German record company, and these guys all were huge in Germany. Germany was like the second market. It would be America, Germany, Japan, and then maybe the UK. You know, that's generally the order anyway of the world record hierarchy was America, Japan, Germany, UK. So Joe Cocker would be on tour. And he'd be in Germany for 6 weeks or you know, do a lot of dates. And they say, well, we need a record. Since he's here, let's grab him and do a record. And him and Chris Norman was exactly the same. He says, yeah, but I need somebody that speaks English. And, hey, we got just the guy for you. So they'd send me somewhere. And, you know, I have a couple of beers with Joe or Chris Norman and say, yeah. And Chris is... And Joe said, yeah, love it. Come on down. As long as you speak English, because he didn't want to fight with a German producer. And so, you know, brought him down and recorded it. And it was also a movie soundtrack, which was the number one single and made it onto his greatest hits album. I don't know who off to get that done, but I'm happy for it, grateful for it, because I wrote it. And Chris Norman's wife was pregnant with, I think, their fifth child. And he was just full of all kinds of domestic stuff he had to take care of. And he was on the road because he owed them an album and he didn't have time to make it, you know, because he's a family man. And, you know, he has five kids and a sixth on the way or four and the fifth on the way, something like that. He says, here's what I need. I said, I need actually a bunch of songs that sound like Chris Norman songs, like Smokey songs. Sad, no problem. So I wrote him five songs, half of the A side of the album. Played all the instruments myself with an engineer, sent the tapes over to him. He loved them. He sang on them, sent them back. I mixed them. So his contribution was just going into his own home studio, because I did this in my home studio, and going down for a couple of days. He put a couple of his guitars on. It sounded like Chris Norman playing guitar and sang. He's a great singer. But my songs, my lyrics, he didn't have to like break his head too much about it. And he could deliver the album that he needed to keep on his schedule while his wife was 9 months, 8-9 months pregnant and bugging him about everything, you know. He didn't need the heat. So that's how that worked out.
Fantastic. Incredible stories.
Yeah, great, huh? That's really funny. And he was a great guy. I only met him twice and talked to him on the phone a couple of times, but he was a fantastic guy. And I understood completely where he was at because I had kids of my own. And I know what pregnant wives are like when there's a record due. And I had like empathy pure for what his.
Say no more, Chris. Situation. I know what you need.
Yeah. Just say no more. Say no more. And I sent him five. I thought he'd take three. He took all five and sang them back. And he came back great. And I mean, the label liked him. He liked him. I liked him. They sold well. So, you know, mission accomplished.
Absolutely. Mission accomplished. And just quickly, touching on health issues. I mean, you had bladder cancer, didn't you, a number of years ago?
Not for very long.
Thankfully, all gone now, all clear now.
Man, I got lucky. I won't go into any graphic detail, but the way you know you got bladder cancer, if there's something, when you go to the bathroom, if you see something you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And I saw a drop of blood, which could have meant anything from a bladder infection, like nothing at all. But me being not oblivious for once, went to the doctor, and it was a long process to get it diagnosed. But by long, I say a couple of months, not real long. And we finally figured out I had two tumors in my bladder, inside the bladder. So what they did was they took my bladder out, and I didn't have any chemotherapy, didn't have any radiation. It didn't spread. It was just the easiest horrible thing you which is like a contradiction, but it's the easiest awful thing you could possibly have. And this is 14 years ago. And, you know, I was really, really fortunate, because most people, first of all, wouldn't necessarily be studying their output with an intensity enough to see one drop of blood go by.
Yeah.
First of all, not paying that much attention. And second, would think, oh, I'll take antibiotics, it's a bladder infection, you know, or something. But I said, no, I want to find out what it is. And they did. So it was more dramatic than I'm making it out to be. But the point is that it was a lot less dramatic than it could have been. And I'm cancer free. From the minute they took the bladder out, I was cancer free. It hadn't spread anywhere. So
fantastic news. And a great reason to get checked if there's any, even the slightest thing different or wrong with you.
Well, I tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, if you see anything in your urine that shouldn't be there, like blood, or it looks brown even, go to the doctor.
Yeah.
Because that shouldn't be there, and there's a reason it's there, and find out what it is.
Absolutely. And just in terms of what you're up to now, I mean, what are you doing these days then, Tony? Are you out on the road? Are you still recording? Are you producing? What's happening with you?
I'm producing and record. I pretty much gave it off the road. I was on the road until the pandemic came. I toured Norway, Scandinavia, Germany, Norway, Sweden, when I say Scandinavia, Denmark, Germany. I play Italy, Spain, and maybe 30, 40 dates a year. And, you know, I'll be 70 in a couple months. But the pandemic killed the music business. You'll hear it from everybody, and you'll read it everywhere. And it's true. I mean, if you need a tour bus, first of all, you either can't find one, or they're $20,000 a week, or more. And if you need a crew, you either can't find one, or they cost four times what they cost in 2019, because most of the people that work in the peripheral music industry, like the truck drivers, the riggers, the guys that do the lights, the guys who do the sound, the guys that are guitar techs and keyboard techs. Well, they have families too, you know. In Germany, as it happens, a lot of them went to work for the railroad, and a lot of them were truck drivers, because long haul trucking pays really, really well. It pays better than rock and roll. It's maybe not as exciting, but it keeps the family fed, and a lot of people like change jobs, and that completely destroyed the industry. So I do have, I'll give a little plug. We have a group called the Soulmates. This is a super group. In a real sense of the word, and in this group, it's called Mandoki's Soulmates. And Leslie Mandoki is like Germany's Quincy Jones. He's a producer. He's produced everybody: Phil Collins, Lionel Richie, Jennifer Rush, lots and lots and lots of people. And he's one of my oldest friends, and he's a great guy. I love him. This and that. He's got a group. He's had it for 30 years. We have. They keep dying on us, people keep dying on us. But we've got Jack Bruce, Chaka Khan, David Clayton Thomas, Steve Lukather.
Wow.
Simon Phillips is playing drums on a new album, which we're in the middle of making now. I'm a singer. I play Hammond organ, and I'm one of lead singers. And the other one is Nick Ead from Cutting Crew.
Yeah. Nick
Ead. Real great guy, great singer.
Yeah.
And Chaka's going to sing. Wow. And John Anderson's going to sing. Anderson from Jethro Tull plays the flute. Richard Bona, who's the world's greatest, he's Jaco Pastorius reincarnated from Africa, plays bass. And we have a jazz element. We have Randy Brecker on trumpet, Mike Stern on guitar, Bill Evans on sax. These are all like Hall of Fame jazz cats. Our average age is about 112. And it's amazing that we're all still around. But we get together, make an album, and we'll do, this year we're doing 79 dates as Soulmates. We're going to play, and we play for governments more than like we played in Peking when it was still called Peking before it was Beijing. We played in South America. We played in Chile. We played in New York. We played in Berlin. And we play every year in Budapest. for 50,000 people on their national holiday, which is like the American 4th of July or your Boxer Day, you know, whatever. And so Mandoki's soulmate said, we'll be playing in Hungary. Leslie's Hungarian. He's like a Hungarian folk hero. Mm-hmm. So we'll play in two Budapest and then another city in Hungary, which would be both like for 50,000 people. But it's not, we play for, they're like folk fest, street festivals, you know, and we don't sell tickets to those. The government pays for it because it costs a freaking fortune because you're flying people in from the United States, from China. One of our guest soloists is a lady that plays a classical piano for the Chinese National Orchestra, and we get her a visa, and she comes over, and she doesn't speak anything. She's got a translator with her, and she comes and does her bit. And John Halliwell from Supertramp, is with us this time. And oh man, you wouldn't believe Jack Bruce. We had Jack Bruce before he died. Greg Lake before he died. And just this revolving cast of characters who enjoy doing it. It's the kind of thing where you got to leave your ego at the door, you know. I mean, if Greg Lake's with us, we're going to do Lucky Man, you know, for sure. And if Jack Bruce is with us, we're going to do Sunshine of Your Love. And because I'm with us, we're going to do Room with a View, which is my European hit. But I mean, last year's program, we took Bartok, Hungarian Pictures was the name of this classical piece from turn of the 20th century, at quite revolutionary, out there, lends itself great to jazz rock. And we made this 72-minute double album called Hungarian Pictures, we produced it in four continents for tons and tons of money. But you know, we got Audi sponsors it and Mercedes sponsors it, and because, you know, nobody can afford to pay for that these days. So that's what I'm doing pretty much this year.
Wow.
Mandoki's soulmates.
I feel ashamed to say I've never heard that name.
We have been in England. We played the Hammersmith Odeon, which is not the Hammersmith Odeon anymore. It's the something
Apollo
else.
Apollo or something, yeah.
But it's the Odeon. It's the same one I played with Rainbow.
Yeah.
In 1976, we played there in 2019, just as our, I guess. But you know, I don't know if you know Corey Henry, but he's the world's hottest jazz keyboard player these days. All these names, and they put us up in Kensington Gardens, Hilton, and all this everything 5-star first class. It was all sponsored, you know, because what we cost, you'd never make it. You'd have to charge $1,000 a ticket, and nobody cares that much anyway. It's just kind of jazz rock, but that's a lot of fun. And like I said, if they keep dying, I'll be the real lead singer. But now I sing. Nick Eade sings, and Leslie sings.
Wow, that is incredible.
The new album is turning out wonderfully, as they all do, and it'll be out in January on Sony Records. And it'll be one of the very last physical releases that Sony Records do, by the way. They're phasing out of physical in 2025. And this is be expensive, lovely package, double vinyl, and, you know, triple CD or whatever, triple vinyl, double CD, whatever, big deal package. It'd be one of the last ones that they do. And happy in the right time, in the right place, happy to be a part of that. And these are friends of mine and fantastic musicians. It's the first time Simon Phillips has played with us. He's fabulous.
Yeah.
He's just amazing. You know, like you'd expect he would be. He's just like you'd expect. He's that good. Like you'd think he'd be, you know, so cool.
Incredible. Well, I've enjoyed this hour sitting with you, Tony, and hearing all your stories, and you've left off with an absolute cracker. I'm going to be going away and listening to that and making sure that I get hold of that release in January as well. Sounds
you know
fantastic.
What? Send me, I have your email address.
Yes, you do.
I'll send you a YouTube link. But kids, that's Mandoki's Soulmates, Mandoki Soulmates. It's on YouTube. We're pretty good. Go have a look. And thank you, Paul.
You've got enough names in there. Thank you so much for your time, Tony. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Okay, man. See ya.
There you go, the brilliant Tony Carey there. Such a fascinating career he's had. Obviously, the iconic Rising album will be what many people focus on, but his own solo records, Planet P Project, his production credits, and the Mandoki Soulmates, which is something I've definitely checked out. Such an incredible thing. You should check it out as well. So that's it for me and this week's Big Interview Show. Thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app so that you get all the episodes. Please leave a Vintage Rock Pod a 5-star review on the podcast app that you use. It really makes a big difference. And look for Vintage Rock Pod on YouTube as well, and you can get to watch these fantastic interviews with the rock stars in person too. And I'll hopefully be back next week with another brilliant interview for you on Vintage Rock Pod. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.